Hey guys, Aaron here. Please stay tuned after today's podcast for a brief message. Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of Snafu. Please visit our website and our Patreon page for bonus content such as pictures of the characters, maps of the airfield, Q&A episodes, and much, much more. This podcast contains explicit content that may not be suitable for some audience members. Listener's discretion is advised. Palmer's restaurant was jam-packed as everyone was attempting to grab a bite to eat before catching the much-anticipated show at the luxurious theater known as Hines Hall. Jack was sitting across from a beautiful brunette woman with eyes that could seduce a man into giving her his soul. Jack felt a little nervous about tonight since he barely had enough money to take Marlene out to dinner and to show. He had saved up nearly 3 paychecks to pay for this evening, and he hoped that this woman, who he had become crazy for, was enjoying herself and forever would remember this night. The two of them were sharing a milkshake, which apparently was the only reason why Marlene told Jack she wanted to come here. She had heard for years that this restaurant had the best milkshakes, and Marlene wanted to try one since she hadn't had a milkshake since she was a little girl when her father made some for her birthday. Jack and Marlene were making small talk, and Jack enjoyed every moment he shared with her. She had this fiery nature to her that was unlike most women he had met. Jack was shy by nature, and while Marlene was too, she seemed to evoke a confidence in him that pushed him to go out of his comfort zone and try new things. Working for her father was a great experience, as he was the kind of man Jack wanted to be. Confident, bold, yet gentle and charismatic. He was someone who carried himself like a man on a mission, but wouldn't be afraid to stop and help someone in need along the way. Jack watched as Marlene took another sip of the milkshake, which was perfect for the early July evening. Jack's face couldn't help but break out in the biggest dimple-laden smile that his face could handle because of Marlene's idiosyncrasies that made Jack want to go to hell and back for her. Jack suddenly began laughing to himself as he was amused as Marlene stopped the story she was telling to make a face that Jack could only describe as goofy yet adorable. Her eyebrows scrunched up, her lips were pushed over her teeth, and she attempted to cover her face. Seeing Jack's face looking at her, Marlene burst out into laughter. She was experiencing a brain freeze from mindlessly drinking the milkshake too fast. The two giggled for some time, and soon, the two lovebirds were heading out of the restaurant and making their way to the theater for a wonderful night. Unbeknownst to Marlene, tonight was going to be the night that Jack would ask her to marry him. One year and 8 months later, March 25th, 1944, United States Army Air Force Station 186, Thurlow, England, 0800. The men of the Bull were dressed in their flag clothes inside of their ice-covered bomber, awaiting for today's mission to be canceled. The mission was delayed due to thick clouds over the target, and the icy rainstorm that had slammed the English countryside late last night was still coming down. The men were shocked that there was even a mission planned for today. The weather was so awful that battle-hardened, experienced men were even in shock. The mission that the men were selected to fly today was to bomb the U-boat pens at Saint-Nazaire, France, which sat on France's western coast overlooking the infamous Bay of Biscay. The men were expected to face fierce fighter attacks, thick flak, and less than acceptable flying conditions. What made this mission even more dreadful was the fact that Colonel Poole personally selected the boss and his crew of Lota Bull to lead the 300th and the other two bomb groups of the second group of the formation to and from the target. This meant that the pressure was on for the boss and Jack, but more so on Rosie, as he would be responsible for not just releasing the bombs, but finding the target too. Every bomber in the second group would be dropping their bombs when he dropped his. Following the boss and Rosie's lead was Texas with Love flying the number 2 spot, Dropping Deuces flying the number 3 spot, Georgia Belle flown by Lieutenant Clyde Duke in the number 4 spot, Cap'n Kids flown by Lieutenant Sean Bernhausen in the number 5 spot, and finally, Paper Doll flown by Lieutenant Bill Rausch in the number 6 spot. The boss had told Rosie that he had faith in him and that he knew Rosie was going to do a good job today and to not let the things he had said just days before get to him. It wasn't an apology, but to Rosie, it was enough. However, the boss and Jack hadn't had any endearing moments since Jack's drunken rant 2 days previous. The boss kept quiet and didn't say anything to Jack unless it had something to do with the mission. Jack felt ashamed at what he had said to the boss, even though O'Brien had to inform Jack on what he said, since Jack couldn't remember. Jack physically looked tired and worn down, far from the man that he was when he left home, so much so that people like Marlene would be shocked to see him now. But yet, Jack felt that he was close enough to the man that he was, that he would be able to return to the man that he was. People like Parnell had told Jack that what he said needed to be said, and that it was good for the boss to hear the cold hard truth. But Jack didn't like being the person who had to give the cold hard truth, especially in a drunken speech. Honestly, the fact that Jack couldn't even tell the boss what was bothering him unless he was blackout intoxicated made Jack feel like he was a huge coward. That's not the kind of thing his parents had taught him. That wasn't the kind of person his dad was, or his old friend Mr. Weathers was, or his soon-to-be father-in-law was. Jack was standing in the doorway of the radio room, talking with Tommy, Willie, and Skimpy. Mills, Beans, and Pally were outside, underneath the right wing, taking cover from the icy rain. Mills was smoking a cigarette, complaining about the weather, while Beans and Pally listened and added to the complaints. Rosie and Andy were both sitting quietly in the nose of the bull. Andy was sitting in his navigator's desk, trying not to focus on the blood-stained wooden floor from Cobb, which Rosie had to fill Andy in on what happened. Rosie was sitting in the bombardier's chair and was looking over pictures of the target, studying every detail of the black-and-white photograph. The boss was standing underneath Deuce's right wing, smoking with Hillhouse and Benson, going over the mission. With every minute that passed by, the men grew more and more assured that the mission was going to be canceled. However, 20 minutes later, the men were all surprised when a jeep drove by the 530th Squadron hardstands and informed everyone that engines would be starting in 10 minutes. Jack, who had since gone outside to smoke with Beans and Mills, looked up and saw that the clouds looked to be thinning out. It was still cold, miserable, icy, and gloomy.
"You really think they're going to be sending us up in this shit?" Mills complained.
"Brass, I guess, thinks we've had enough time off. We've got to get back to work sometime," Jack retorted.
"Oh, but don't the Germans have a day to take off to shove their faces full of sauerkraut and chase it down with a beer?"
Beans asked.
"Well, why do you think we only fly 2 or 3 missions a week? We're on break. We're ready to go back and play war now,"
Jack replied, as the men began walking to the waste compartment door.
"If that's true, then why don't we just bomb them when they're on break?"
Mills asked.
"Mills, don't you know? It's never that simple. If we did that, the war would have been over a year ago," Jack said.
"And why is that a problem?" Mills asked with a smile on his face, knowing that Jack was joking.
"Because if you Come all this way across the world to fight a war? You at least gotta make it worth your while, Jack sarcastically said before getting inside the bomber. Once inside, Jack moved his way through the bomber. As he did, he walked past two extra ammo crates, which Beans, Mills, and Pally had grabbed since their overall weight was lighter than what they had on previous missions. Jack entered into the radio room and checked with Skimpy one last time to see if he was ready for the busy day. Skimpy replied that he was in fact ready, and that was when Jack saw a picture of Emma stuck to his radio receiving box. Looking at the photo, Jack commented on how cute she looked and how lucky Skimpy was. Then, Jack patted Skimpy on the shoulder and proceeded to walk through the bomb bay and took notice of the 4 1,000-pound general-purpose bombs and the 10 100-pound armor-piercing bombs that all hung in their racks, ready to be released. Next, Jack entered into the cockpit, where he found Willie looking over his top turret again, double-checking everything. Sitting in his seat, Jack saw that the boss wasn't in his seat yet. Since the boss and Jack had done pre-flight checks earlier, Jack decided to look over the checklist one more time. The boss soon entered into the cockpit and sat down, plugged in his audio cord, and put his headset on. Jack followed by doing the same. What are you doing? The boss asked, connecting his throat microphone. Going over the checklist again, Jack said. Oh, okay. Think I missed something? The boss asked. Nope. Just double checking, Jack awkwardly replied. The boss nodded his head and kept his eyes forward. Jack then pressed on his throat microphone and announced to the men over the intercom that they all needed to call in and double check their intercom lines to see if they were working. One by one, each man called in, and all was working perfectly. Butch had worked like a madman to fix Loda Bull's nose section. He even recruited extra help to redo the entire intercom system inside the nose. He also took the chin turret off of a B-17 which had crash-landed a few weeks earlier and put it on the bull. Jack looked down at his watch and saw that they just had 30 seconds until their scheduled engine start. Jack then looked over at the boss and said, "You know, I'll gladly take the controls during assembly and give them back to you once we hit the English coast. Give you a break. You know, sound good?" "Don't try to win brownie points with me," the boss softly said. "I'm not winning brownie points. I'm taking charge, just like you said you wish I did. I'm taking the controls either way. 3, 2, 1, and..." Jack said, looking up and seeing a green flare shoot up into the sky above the control tower. Over the next 10 minutes, all 20 B-17 selected to fly today's mission had started their engines and were taxiing to the runway, being led by Loda Bull. Once the crew arrived at the western end of Runway 3, the boss turned the plane to the right, facing the east. Jack looked out of his window to watch the green flare gun be shot from the control tower, but was stunned to see Parnell and his three officers, standing with Brolin and his three officers waving them off. The men were standing about 100 feet or so from the edge of the runway, not too far from where Chaplain Schwartz was standing on the back of his Jeep, giving the sign of the cross and saying a prayer for each plane that was going to pass by him. Suddenly, Jack saw the green flare, and it was time for them to take off. Soon, Loda Bull roared down the runway, passing by Chaplain Schwartz and Parnell's group, before lifting off the ground about 3/4 of the way down the runway. As Loda Bull turned to their left, Beans, Mills, and Pally, all three got up from the radio room floor and made their way to their gunnery stations. Once they made an almost complete circle around the airfield, Skimpy left his radio station and stood in the waste compartment and watched as they passed over Emma's house, which Skimpy was shocked to see Emma standing in the back of her house, waving the men off as he passed over her house. 2 hours later, the formation of 277 bombers were flying 25,000 feet over their second waypoint, which was over the main island of Guernsey. The men had just test-fired their guns, and Tommy was now in his turret. The clouds were thick as the formation crossed the channel, but were thinning out over France. Jack had been handling the controls since they began forming up over Thurlow, and the boss was at the controls of the engines. The escort fighters that day were two squadrons of P-47 Thunderbolts.
and the men of the Bull were in awe at one specific little friend. The P-47G had an impressive painting of flames going from its engine to the middle of its fuselage. It was very rare to see planes this decorated, and people like Pally were mesmerized by it every time it flew past a formation.
Bogey spotted, 4 o'clock high,
called in Skimpy, who was stunned when he saw the specks off in the distance.
I see him. Holy shit,
Willie said.
What?
Asked Jack.
There's a lot of them,
Willie commented.
How many?
Asked the boss.
Oh, I don't know, 2 dozen maybe? What do you think, Pally?
Willie asked.
It looks right. What kind are they? Does anyone know?
Pally asked.
Nope,
responded Beans.
All right, men. Keep your eyes open. Call out those fighters,
the boss commanded.
Rosie and Andy, do you need any help down there?
Jack asked.
We're okay down here, Jack,
Andy responded.
Rosie?
Jack asked.
All good,
Rosie confirmed. As the next 4 minutes passed by, the P-47s began attacking the four squadrons of FW-190s. Half of the German fighters were unfazed by the American escort since they outnumbered them 2-1, and continued heading towards the formation. Pally aimed his guns in the direction of the fighters that were now hurling themselves towards the formation at speeds of over 400 miles an hour.
Here they come, 5 o'clock high,
Pally called in over the intercom. The 190s focused their attacks on the bombers flying in groups 4 and 5. Within that attack, two B-17s from the 5th group were sent downwards towards Earth after the very skilled 190 pilots triangulated their attacks in an impressive, overwhelming force. The sight was so intimidating that Pally was stunned and almost to a frozen-like state.
109 going down, 6 o'clock low. Friendly got him,
Tommy called in.
190 coming in, 7 o'clock low,
Mills called in just before he began firing his guns at the incoming 190. Mills' tracers came close to hitting, not the fighter, but the tail section of dropping deuces, as Mills was trailing the incoming fighter. The 190 banked upward and soon left Mills' sights. Mills took in a deep breath, wiping the sweat from his brow, as he almost made a close friendly fire. In the radio room, Skippy was firing his guns at a 190 flying towards them at their 5 o'clock position. As the 190 maneuvered its way around, Skimpy realized that the P-47 with the detailed painting of the flames was following behind by 80 or so yards and closing in. Skimpy, and then Beans, watched as the 190 let off a stream of bullets right into Texas's left wing and fuselage. However, none of the gunners stopped firing, and none of their engines caught fire or began trailing anything. Nevertheless, the desperate and gutsy German pilot came so close to ramming into Texas's tail section that Beans flinched, expected to see Texas be turned into a collided mess. But luckily, the 190 pulled up just in time, but not before Texas had another close call when the escort P-47 that was following it almost collided with the bomber as well. But luckily, it too pulled up just at the right time.
Oh, did anyone see that? Flame 47 almost ran into Texas,
Beans called in. In between firing his guns, Willie responded,
Yes, let's talk. More killing. Roger that,
Bean said, cocking his gun, and then aimed it at a 109 getting ready to pass by underneath the formation.
Here comes one, Pally. 5 o'clock low. Watch it,
Beans called in over the intercom. In the tail, Pally held his guns toward the direction that Beans had just called in, and sure enough, a 190 appeared, sending bullets in the Bull's direction. None of them came close, and Pally aimed his guns on the incoming fighter and let off a quick burst of bullets, only to see the 190 flip upside down, ready to escape, and then bursting into flames. Pally quit firing and called in.
I got one! Holy shit, I got one! Sorry to break it to you, Pally, but I saw a waste gunner from Deuces actually hit it,
Tommy called in.
Are you sure?
Pally responded.
Positive. Sorry, Pally,
said Tommy. Pally then, out of anger, aimed his guns down in the direction of the 109 headed towards them in the low 6 o'clock position and let off a few angry bursts. None of them came close to hitting anything.
B-17 going down, 306th, 11 o'clock low,
Rosie called in.
Watch for shoots,
the boss commented.
I'm on it, boss,
Andy commented as he was using his left cheek gun and was able to keep his eyes on the down plane.
T-190's coming in, 7 o'clock high,
Pally said just before he fired his gun at the two incoming planes. Pally watched as one of the 190s banked downward and let off a stream of bullets in the direction of the bombers flying in the 528th Squadron, which was flying in the low squadron. Mills began following the fighter, getting off one stream of gunfire before he watched the bullets from the 190 strike the left wing of a plane flying in the number 3 spot of the low squadron. As the fighter escaped, Mills saw the B-17's number 1 engine start to trail smoke and oil.
B-17 from the 528 hit, losing oil and output engine.
Mills called in. Skippy left his gun for a moment and looked out to see if he could identify the bomber that Mills was referring to so that he could get the nose art or tail number. However, he couldn't see over Bull's left wing.
Are they falling behind, Mills?
Jack asked.
No, they're feathering the engine, though.
Mills said.
Okay, try to keep your eye on them, Mills.
Said the boss.
Got it, boss.
Mills responded.
190 going down. 4 o'clock low. He's bailing out.
Tommy called in as he watched the smoking 109 fall down towards Earth after being shot down by a gunner in the group behind him.
2190's coming in, 6 o'clock low. Watch it, Tommy.
Pally then called in.
Oh shit, I see him. Come on, come on.
Tommy uttered as he aimed his sights on the two planes. Both planes zipped past the bomber in the third group, and one of them became a dead stick. Just before Tommy called it in, his heart sank as another 190 made a hard turn and let off a stream of fire in the bull's direction, which one bullet landed in the right horizontal stabilizer. The fighter then banked to the right and let off two more lines of fire, which tore into Deuce's radio room in bomb bay. Luckily, none of the bombs detonated.
Deuce's is hit.
Tommy panicked in the intercom.
Bad?
Asked Jack as he tried to see for himself but couldn't see them.
Not bad. I'll keep an eye on them, Jack.
Beans added as he saw the hits occur and fired upon the 190 just before it disappeared. On the other side of the waste compartment, Mills was still keeping his eye on the bomber from the 528th Squadron and watched as the plane began to fall behind. However, for whatever reason, the pilot slightly banked his plane to the left and away from the formation.
Oh shit, plane from the 528th falling out of formation.
Mills called in.
Oh, come on guys, what are they doing?
Tommy muttered a few seconds later.
What the hell is he doing?
Mills asked.
I don't know. Oh no, 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 no!
Tommy said as he watched three 190s jump on the wounded bomber, tearing it to shreds. Mills and Tommy both watched as the B-17 practically fell apart as the five 190s took turns unloading their ammo into the wounded beast, hoping to get credit for the down heavy.
B-17 from 528 going down.
Mills said as he watched the plane fall down towards Earth in multiple fragments.
Any shoots?
Asked Skimpy.
Not a single one.
Mills said.
I hate to break this up, fellas. 4190's coming in, 4 o'clock high.
Willie called in just before he let off long streams of gunfire in the Germans' direction. The four planes flew through the lines of fire. One of them was hit and soon collided with a B-17 flying in the group behind them.
B-17 going down, 381st, 6 o'clock low, collision.
Pally begrudgingly uttered. The other three 190s broke off from their flight paths, and one of them flew directly into Pally's line of sights. Pally pushed his trigger down quickly, and soon he watched as his bullets ripped into the tail of a 190, but it continued flying. As the fighter disappeared away from the formation, Pally, out of frustration and anger, punched the metal plate between his legs. Over the next 4 minutes, the rest of the 190s focused their attacks on groups 4 and 5. Soon, the undefeated P-47s chased the rest of the fighters away, relieving the men for the time being. Within 5 minutes, the formation arrived over the French coast, 25,000 feet above the small French coastal village of Plévion. As the men crossed over Brittany, they watched as a smaller formation of B-25s flying below them at 18,000 feet bombed a communications outpost in Point V, only 3 miles to the left of them. Do you want to get more out of Snafu? Well, guess what? There's good news for you because you can. By becoming a supporter of the podcast, you will receive bonus content such as pictures and profiles of all the characters mentioned in today's episode, pictures and maps of the airfield and surrounding areas, as well as formation breakdowns of past, present, and future missions, as well as Q&A episodes and behind-the-scenes episodes. There is so much for you to gain by donating $3 or $10 to help support the podcast. If you would like to be a part of Snafu each week, please visit our Patreon page. The link for that's down in the show notes. Any support goes a long way in helping the podcast to continue. Thank you to those who have already subscribed and are currently supporting this podcast. Your contribution makes a difference. Now, back to the podcast. 40 minutes later, the formation had arrived at the fourth waypoint, which was 30,000 feet above the island of Belle and was located 50 miles west of the French coast, specifically Saint-Nazaire. The Little Friends had recently broke off from the formation and headed back to England, leaving the bombers exposed until after the rally point, when they would be reconnected with escort fighters to take them back home. The formation had turned to the south in order to align themselves with the channel that led them to the coastal city. In the ball turret, Tommy watched as the French coast appeared on the horizon. Then he saw that the area that they would soon be turning towards was for the most part clear of any thick clouds. This, mixed with the fact that all 200 bombers in the formation were trailing white contrails, the formation was clearly visible from the ground, and would only mean that the flak would be more accurate that day. Tommy, aiming his turret downward, saw a handful of ships going in and out of the harbor.
"Do you think we're going to be sinking any ships today?"
Tommy asked.
"No, I don't chatter, guys. And, yes,"
Jack responded, as he himself looked downward through his side window and saw one ship heading away from the harbor. Jack wondered if they cleared the harbor knowing the bombers were coming. Minutes later, the bombers then turned to the east and headed for the city of Saint-Nazaire once they hit the decision point. Rosie sat in his bombardier's chair and hunched over his bomb sight, getting himself ready for the bomb run. Sitting in the cockpit, Jack, oddly enough, began thinking about the night he proposed to Marlene. He remembered walking out of the theater, walking her down Penn Avenue on their way back to the train station. He remembered that moment like it was yesterday. He stopped her at the corner of Penn Avenue and 7th Street, across from the Pittsburgh Theater Company, which was one of Marlene's favorite places, since that's where her and Jack went on their first date. For Jack, the theater was a big reminder of how far he had come. When he met Marlene, he could only afford to take her to see a show at the theater, even though she always wanted to see a production at Heinz Hall. Jack couldn't afford it. But now, he was somewhat able to afford it. Jack remembered kneeling down on one knee at the corner and did so that Marlene would be facing the front of the theater. He remembered taking out the ring and putting it on Marlene's hand and seeing the beaming glow on Marlene's face, which compared to the darkness of the Pittsburgh sky that night, it only made her face shine brighter. It was only when Jack realized that people around them weren't clapping or cheering that he hadn't asked Marlene the big question. He was so nervous that he forgot. Stuttering it out, Marlene said yes before Jack even got it out of his mouth, and Jack embraced her on that street corner and did so with a crowd of people clapping and cheering the two lovebirds. Jack would have given anything to relive that moment.
"Navigator to pilot, we're at the IP,"
Andy called in over the intercom, snapping Jack out of his dreamlike state.
"Okay, Rosie, I'm giving you the plane. Autopilot on. She's all yours,"
the boss called over the intercom as he gave Rosie the controls of the plane.
"Roger that. We're on the bomb run,"
Rosie said. He then reached over to a group of levers and slid one of them forward and announced,
"Bomb bay doors opening."
In the cockpit, a horrifying sound screeched behind them in the bomb bay.
"What the hell is that sound?"
Jack asked, looking at the boss. As the boss and Jack tried to figure out where the sound was coming from, Mills called over the intercom.
"Flak 3 o'clock low."
Flak then began exploding all around the sky. Among the chaos, Tommy solved the mystery when he called over the intercom.
"Guys, the bomb bay doors are not opening."
Hearing this, Willie came down from his top turret and checked the bomb bay, and sure enough, the bomb doors were closed.
"Rosie, try opening the bomb doors again,"
the boss called over the intercom. Rosie was focused on trying to find the smaller target, which was 30,000 feet below him, and was trying to lock his bomb sight onto it, which then he would enter the wind drift, altitude, and other components into the analog computer built inside the bomb sight. He was so focused that he didn't hear the boss speaking.
Rosie!
The boss asked.
What?
Rosie asked.
Open the bomb doors again. Okay.
Rosie said, sliding the door lever downward, and then waited a few seconds, and then slid it back up, while trying to look through his bomb sight the entire time. In the bomb bay, Willie was checking the bomb doors and saw that the hydraulic pistons were not moving. Willie, knowing what was going on and knowing that his time was running out, took his oxygen mask off, took out his audio cord, and went back into the radio room where he grabbed the manual crank and then returned to the door of the bomb bay and the cockpit, bent downward, and immediately began cranking the bomb doors open. Jack, after seeing this, jumped out of his seat, grabbed Willie's oxygen mask, and transferred it over to his portable tank, and handed it to Willie and said to him,
I got it. Put your mask on, you crazy fuck.
Willie agreed as he was already starting to feel lightheaded. He stepped back in the narrow catwalk and put his oxygen mask on and began taking deep breaths. As Jack cranked the bomb doors open as fast as he could, he then realized that below him, the bomb doors were slowly opening, and he could see the water of the Bay of St. Nazaire, 30,000 feet below him, with black clouds passing by underneath him. Up in the nose, Rosie was able to locate the target and lock his crosshairs on the aiming point, which was at the top of the loading dock. The Norton bombsight was now flying the plane to the target and would release the bombs when the computer reached the calculated spot. If Rosie made a mistake on the calculations or the data, then all the B-17s flying in Group 2 would be off target along with him. His brow was drenched in a nervous sweat.
60 seconds to target,
Rosie called in. In the bomb bay, Jack finally got the bomb doors open, and just as he turned around to tell Willie, a flagship exploded just above the bomb bay, punching a half dozen small holes into the top of the airplane. The blast nearly knocked Jack off the catwalk and into the open sky below them. Willie, on the other hand, was safe, for he was in between the middle section where the internal bomb racks were located and provided support. Jack gave Willie the okay sign, and Willie nodded his head, but Jack could tell that Willie was scared out of his mind. Jack then handed Willie the crank, and when Willie turned around to go back to the radio room, Jack saw that Willie's parachute had been hit, but judging by the long gashes, none of the pieces of flak punctured past his parachute. Jack went into the radio room to tell Willie, and as he did, another flak shell went off in the waste compartment. Jack saw Mills and Beans both fall to the floor. Jack quickly entered into the waste compartment, while Willie checked Tommy's ball turret. When Jack arrived at Beans and Mills, both of them were fine, and were sent to the floor only by the violent blast that made the entire back of the plane move. However, looking up, the top of the waste compartment and the tail fin route, where the vertical stabilizer met the fuselage, was peppered with holes, and one hole was punched in just above Beans' gunner's window. In the nose, Rosie watched the flight path needle move downward towards the contact needle, knowing that once the two needles met, he had to release the bombs. For a moment, it was like watching the second hand ticking towards a specific position on a clock. A flagship exploded just in front of the nose cone. Most of the shrapnel bounced off the plane, but a large piece of shrapnel pierced through the plexiglass cone and was lodged into the floor underneath Rosie's right foot, missing it by less than an inch. The close call shocked and stunned Rosie, but he had to keep his concentration. Then, in a flash, the two needles met, and Rosie hit the bomb toggle and called out,
"Bombs away!"
In the radio room, Willie watched as the bombs fell from their racks, with the exception of one, which was suspended on the left outer rack along the side of the bomb bay. The bomb was one of the general-purpose bombs, and Willie watched as the bomb on top of it was released and bounced off the jammed bomb and proceeded to fall away from the plane. Willie again grabbed one of the manual cranks and headed to the bomb bay. Jack, who was helping Mills and Beans get up, just happened to see Willie and went over to him. Jack arrived in the bomb bay to see Willie, who fearlessly unhooked the catwalk rope, and with flak shells going off all around him, and France 30,000 feet between his legs, he threw his left leg across the open cavity, and with his left hand he grabbed onto a metal rib, and with his right hand he took the crank and used it as a hammer, and began hitting it between the armed bomb and the rack. Jack stood behind Willie and grabbed onto him, by his parachute harness. Willie gave a few more rams against the bomb release, and finally, the bomb fell away from the bomb bay. As it fell, Jack pulled Willie back onto the catwalk, and a flak shell exploded just next to the plane, and Willie was thrusted forward, and before Jack and Willie knew what was going on, Willie was now hanging out of the bomb bay, only being suspended by Jack holding onto his parachute strap. Jack was thrown onto the catwalk, and was slowly slipping downward to the left from the weight of Willie's body and the fact that the bomber was tilting to the left as it was turning on its heading. Skippy jumped in action almost immediately and grabbed Jack by pulling his parachute harness. With his audio cord and oxygen line being pulled at its maximum length, almost to the point of being disconnected and possibly damaged, Skippy, whose body was pumping with pure adrenaline, was the only thing stopping Jack and Willie from falling out of the bomber.
Help! Jesus Christ, help!
Was the only thing Skippy could say, but since Skippy didn't engage his microphone, his calls were done in vain, and his oxygen mask muffled his plea. A lifetime seemed to pass as Jack's hand was starting to lose feeling from the intense weight in his hand. Willie's body was flailing as his lower half was being pounded by the slipstream. Jack watched as Willie looked up at Jack with a look of pure terror, an image that gave Jack enough adrenaline and strength to hold his grip. Willie then, using his right arm, grabbed onto the catwalk and attempted to try to pull himself up, but to no avail. Then, a feeling that Jack could only describe as the hand of God lifting him up, he was pulled upward by his parachute harness, and he and Willie were both lifted back into the plane. Willie's chest rammed into the back section of the bomb bay, and he was able to grab onto various metal pieces and sections, and with the help of Jack pulling him, Willie was able to lift himself into the radio room. Once Willie was in the radio room, Jack looked behind him to see Mills and Beans, both standing without their oxygen masks and headphones on. Both of them, with the help of Skimpy, pulled the two men back into the plane.
"You okay?"
Jack asked Willie, pulling his oxygen mask down. Willie took in a deep breath and nodded his head. His eyes heavily showed the relief that Willie felt as he had the bomber's cold floor underneath him. The entire event only lasted 30 seconds, but to Jack and Willie, it felt like half a lifetime. Getting up, Willie gave Skimpy a huge thankful hug, and then patted Mills and Beans on their shoulders, and the men went back to their stations. Jack and Willie begrudgingly and quickly moved through the bomb bay and back into the cockpit. When Jack arrived back in his seat, the boss, who was informed of what was happening, as Tommy saw Willie dangling from the bomb bay, called over the intercom for help, waited until Jack was seated, asked him to take the controls, and then he himself got up and closed the bomb bay doors manually. The formation was flying on their new course, headed towards the rally point, which was over the French town of Durville, which was 36 miles away. The bull continued to jump around from the exploding flak shells going off all around them. In the tail, Pally was sitting at his tail gunner's position, and was a witness to seeing the bombs fall from Rosie's mark. The sight was rather impressive and also terrifying. Thunderous explosions from below meant that the bombs had made contact with their target, and Pally looked down only to see the entire area turn from an industrial and residential area to a harbor of fire, smoke, and debris. Looking upward, Pally watched as a flak shell rammed into the nose section of Paper Doll and exploded. Within a flash, Lieutenant Bill Rausch, his co-pilot, bombardier, and navigator were gone. The decapitated bomber continued flying for a few seconds before it began falling away. While this was happening, Pally called in.
Paper Doll's gone!
The boss, who was close with Lieutenant Rausch, was stunned, and even though he couldn't see them, he still attempted to look behind them and catch a glimpse.
God damn it, watch for chutes,
called Mills.
I'm on it,
Tommy said, as he saw the falling bomber through his side lookout window. Tommy and Pally watched as the falling bomber spread out three bodies, which turned into parachutes.
I see three chutes,
Tommy called in.
I only see three as well,
Pally affirmed. The boss was reduced to an emotional simmer, as he felt like what he had just heard was a mistake. He hoped that it was.
Who got out?
Asked Andy.
Looked like the tail gunner and waist gunners. Wait, I think I see one more,
Tommy called in.
Any officers?
The boss asked.
No, they took a direct hit in the nose,
Pally muttered. Jack looked over at the boss and saw disbelief in his eyes. Jack offered to take the controls, to which the boss shook his head, keeping his eyes glued on the horizon. Within the next 3 minutes, the flak lessened and became less and less accurate. The men, however, continued back to England with heavy hearts. Pally, more than anyone, couldn't wrap his head around it. The radio operator on board Paper Doll, Sergeant Neil Florentine from Reno, Nevada, was a replacement that had arrived the same day that he did, and even though the two were not close, he chatted with him on the train ride from Portsmouth to London, and the two arrived in Thurlow together and both dealt with the anxiety of finding their new crews, not knowing what awaited them. The last that he checked, he had become quite acquainted with the men from his crew, and he hadn't talked with them since their first day in Thurlow. Knowing that he could have been the one that didn't make it out of the plane bothered him intensely. For the others, their sadness wasn't rooted in the loss of their buddies, since they didn't know anyone from Paper Doll, but their sadness was from the fact that it only reminded them of the fact that in a split second, a flak shell could make a direct hit of their own plane, and they may not have as much time to make an escape as the four men from Paper Doll did. The boss, however, was stunned into a quiet, automaton state. For him, the loss of Lieutenant Rausch was only a reminder that as much as he wanted to take control and raise his chances of getting himself and his men back home through sheer skill and ability, the feeling of uncertainty and feeling powerless, that feeling that seemed to be haunting him and that he was hiding from, was knocking at his door. The feeling of his fate and the fate of his men being carelessly and ferociously left to chance was something that had been eating at him. And at moments like this, that beast, that soul-crushing feeling was chewing itself through his psyche. He just hoped that men like Duke, Texas, and Hill House made it through the mission.
Do you want to get more in a snafu? Well, guess what? There's good news, because you can. By visiting our website, www.snafupod.net, you can find all kinds of amazing free, that's important, free resources to help you know more about the 8th Air Force in World War II and about the B-17 Flying Fortress. In fact, right now, you can take a virtual tour of two real B-17s like the one depicted in Snafu. Also, you can find links to movies, documentaries, and free, again, free, YouTube videos. There is so much for you to discover. All you have to do is visit www.snafupod.net and check it out for yourself. Now, back to the podcast. 3.5 hours later, the 300th had arrived over Thurlow, and 18 of the 20 planes that departed from Thurlow that morning had returned and landed. The crew of Paper Doll, however, wasn't the only casualty the 300th had suffered, and specifically the 530th Squadron. Texas's tail gunner, who was a fresh replacement, lost his foot due to a piece of flak that cut it clean off. The 18-year-old gunner would be sent back to Detroit with a Purple Heart. Texas landed his plane with no flaps, no brakes, and half of his instruments were disabled due to an electrical issue due to damage from a flak shell. Dropping Deuces took a ton of damage to their underside. Andrewn, their ball turret gunner, returned with a serious concussion after his turret was almost directly hit by a flak shell. By some miracle, his turret was not penetrated and nobody else was injured. But Deuces returned with no hydraulics and had to land by manually lowering their flaps and landing gear. Their flare gun was also hit and sent colorful flames all over the cockpit, which Benson received minor burns, and the top turret gunner only suffered a burn to his hand. The worst of all was Georgia Belle. Georgia Belle was one of the first planes that landed, and the stricken fortress ran the whole length of the runway and went off into the field at the far end of runway 3. The bomber went bottoms up when it ran into the field, and the nose was stuck in the ground, with the tail being suspended in the air. With the help of some of the grounds crewmen, the bomber's tail was lowered, and the men were able to exit safely. Georgia's bombardier,
22-year-old Second Lieutenant David Dixon of Dothan, Alabama, and their navigator, 24-year-old Second Lieutenant Bobby Jones of Jefferson, Missouri, were both killed by a flak shell shortly before the bombs were dropped. Clyde Duke released the bombs and then was killed instantly shortly after when a flak shell exploded just above his head, which also killed our top turret gunner, 19-year-old Roberto Lopez of El Paso, Texas. Their co-pilot, Second Lieutenant Chet Winston from Hartford, Connecticut, who was flying as a replacement, was also hit by that same flak burst and remarkably brought the entire crew back home instead of having them bail out over German territory. The reason for the botched landing was due to the fact that the severely injured 22-year-old co-pilot had lost so much blood that the stress of landing his plane caused him to pass out the moment they touched down. Sadly, after having to be given a blood transfusion in the plane and then lifted out of the seat and out of the cockpit, which was covered in the remains of Clyde Duke, Second Lieutenant Chet Winston would pass away from complications due to his injuries hours after being transported to the hospital. Doctors would come to the conclusion that a metal fragment from the flak burst got into his bloodstream and made it into his heart. He would be put in for a Medal of Honor, which he would be given posthumously. Of the 277 bombers the 8th Air Force sent up on the bombing raid to Saint-Nazaire, France, only 269 returned. Two planes would ditch in the icy waters of the English Channel. One B-17 crash-landed at a British emergency field south of London. The others were shot down or missing in action. On the other hand, a total of 10 German fighters were shot down, and only two P-47s were lost. To the top brass at the 8th Air Force headquarters, this mission was considered a success. Later that night at the officers' club, Rosie was sitting by himself at the bar with a glass of scotch in his hand. He already had several in his stomach and intended to continue on his marathon of drinking until he drank long enough to not give a damn, but sober enough to make it back to his hut. Jack and the others were off with their own groups of friends, and even though Jack offered Rosie a chance to come along, Rosie declined. The day's events were too much for him, and he wanted to be left alone with his thoughts for the evening. Even his new buddy, George Grant from Fenway Bombshell, or Parnell's crew, attempted to get him out and about, but was rejected.
"Hey there. I knew you'd be here. Thought you'd like to see this," the boss said as he approached Rosie, holding a photograph in his hand.
Laying the photograph down on the bar top, Rosie saw what looked like a picture of the target of Saint-Nazaire. The picture looked just like the aerial photograph from the briefing earlier, but this time, the target was covered in bomb craters.
"Do you know what that is?" the boss asked, getting out a fresh cigarette for him to light.
"The target we bombed today?" Rosie asked.
"You know, we were the only group today that actually hit the target. Granted, only 20% of our bombs actually hit the target, the rest went into the harbor. But according to my intelligence connection, who just so happened to let me borrow this picture, told me that we heavily damaged the infrastructure of the U-boat pens, and get this, we even sank a German cargo ship that was passing through the harbor at the time we dropped the bombs. Isn't that something?" the boss said.
"Yeah, it is. So only 20% of our bombs hit the target?"
"Don't think like that. It was a hard target to hit, which is why Colonel Poole was so impressed. In fact, he was so impressed with our efforts today that he wanted me to tell you that if you keep this up, you and myself could be looking at a promotion in the future. Not bad for a bunch of rookies, huh?"
Rosie didn't say anything or show any excitement. The boss was almost offended at Rosie's lack of enthusiasm.
"What's wrong?" the boss asked.
"What's wrong? Didn't you lose two of your friends today?" Rosie asked.
"What? Who? Oh. Yeah, you mean Duke and, Roush. For fuck's sake, Bill Roush," Rosie aggressively expressed after being outraged that the boss couldn't remember Bill's name.
Hey, don't be like that. Am I wrecked over it? You bet your ass I am. God, I want to get blackout pissed tonight, but I can't. I can't afford to lose it now. You should be thinking the same way.
What does Duke and Roush have to do with you? Why are you all doom and gloom?
Rosie slowly turned his head towards the boss, and after downing his drink, set the glass down, grabbed his jacket, and said, "You're just unbelievable."
The boss sat in shock as he watched Rosie leave the officers' club and disappeared into the night. On the other hand, Jack was off at the Cock Inn with the men from his crew. Also with them was Parnell and his three officers, Joe Brolin and his three officers, and the men from Bomb McGee. Jack and Willie both recounted the incident in the bomb bay earlier with the others, and men like Sheila and Coca couldn't get enough of it. Underneath Willie's bombastic manner and his loud persona, he was hiding the fact that both of his hands were shaking. It all started moments after he was pulled back into the plane and escaped from almost falling 30,000 feet with a busted-up parachute. The only one who seemed to notice Willie's tremor was Tommy. Jack treated the men from his crew to a celebratory drink that night for their efforts during the mission. Men like O'Brien warned Jack that while this was a nice gesture, it really wasn't a good idea for him to be so close and personal with the men of his crew. Jack, however, disagreed and subscribed that it would only help the group function more like a team or like a family, instead of officers and enlisted. Jack wasn't the only one who felt this way. Hill House was the one who gave Jack the idea on taking his men out after a mission. In fact, Hill House and Texas were both with their enlisted men in a pub just up the road from Thurlow. Benson and Texas even paid a driver to take them there. Parnell was also someone who subscribed to this idea, although his men were out with their buddies tonight in Haverhill. Later in the night, the men all scattered inside the pub, with Emma and Evelyn joining Skimpy and Mills as they bantered and played games with their crewmates. Jack and the others finally got a chance to meet Emma and were delighted to get to know Evelyn. Jack was ever so happy to see Skimpy and Mills both finding romance in this dark time. He only wished Marlene was here to join him and be a source of comfort and refuge to him. Later in the night, once Jack returned to his hut and most of the men had passed out, or, like Andy, hadn't returned to the hut yet, Jack got out a paper and pencil and began writing his first letter to Marlene since he had arrived in Thurlow. The letter read, "Dear Marlene, I'm sorry for not writing you sooner. It took a while for the mail to get in. Honestly, I didn't quite know how to say what I want to say. I just want you here. I want to be home. I love you and miss you greatly. I've made a lot of friends here. One of them, a guy by the name of Parnell. He's something else. I've never met anyone else like him. He's from Boston and is great. I like my crew. Good guys. Kids, really. Had a close call today, but God said it was not my time. I know God will see me through this, as I'm sure you do too. We have to have faith in something to get us through this, right? How's your family? Last I heard, John's number got called, and he's in the army now. Did you ever find out what division? Infantry? Artillery? Anyways, I was shocked to hear that Annie is now working at the factory in Pittsburgh. I can't see her doing that. What does your mom think of that? What about Lorraine? How's she doing? How's Scott been since he found out that he was a 4F? Anyways, miss you. Please write me as often as you can. One letter a month will simply not cut it. I can't be fighting the enemy with one letter from you a month. Also, if you can, ask your dad to please send some Coca-Cola my way. I know it's been hard for him to get it in at the shop, but I've got a buddy here who is such a fiend for it. We call him Coca. It will make his day, if not his month for sure. Love you always, and I fight every day knowing that at the end of it all, I will be rewarded with seeing your face. Say hi to the family for me. Love your one and only, Jack." Thank you for listening to episode 14 of Snafu, a historical fiction podcast depicting the average life of a bomber crew in World War II.
If you would like more information about the podcast, please visit our website and our Patreon page. Both links are down in the show notes. This podcast is produced by Canso 34 Studios, a DIY project helping to raise awareness to the brave young men who sacrificed their lives in the skies over Europe in World War II. I hope we do it justice. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned next week for episode 15 of Snafu, Rendezvous. Hey guys, Aaron here from Canso 34 Studios. I want to make a quick note here, footnote here, that in today's episode you heard the miraculous yet tragic story about Georgia Bell, and specifically the co-pilot, who told his crew not to bail out over Germany, even though he was on the verge of dying himself, led his crew back, where he would die moments after he landed. The co-pilot is based off of a man by the name of Donald Joseph Gott, who did close to almost the exact same thing in 1944 in the skies over Germany. You can read about his incident at cmohs.org. Again, that's cmohs.org. The link for that's down in the show notes. As I've said before, this podcast, even though it is a historical fiction podcast, the people and men and the experiences in this podcast are inspired by or based off of real people and real events. Thank you guys so much for listening, and take this time to give thanks to the brave young men who sacrificed so much in the skies over Europe in World War II.